You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll look at a new report from the Economic Policy Institute about unions called How Today's Unions Help Working People. First, President Trump has looked beyond Washington to fill key positions in his cabinet and administration. One example is his choice of former presidential rival and neurosurgeon Dr. Ben Carson to lead the Department of Housing and Urban Development, commonly known as HUD. Alec McGillis covers politics and government for ProPublica. His recent article, Is Anybody Home at HUD?, appeared in New York Magazine and is linked on the Central Time Facebook page. Alec, welcome back to the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
Before we get into what's been happening over the last handful of months, what does housing and urban development do?
Well, housing and urban development, HUD, is a department that was founded back in the mid-60s as part of LBJ's Great Society, the War on Poverty, taking on the urban crisis back when we were having the riots. And it has since shrunk somewhat. It's down to about half the size that it was at its peak, but it still does quite a lot. Of course, it oversees the actual public housing that we still have around the country. That housing stock has diminished in recent years, but we still have more than a million units of actual public housing. Then there's the Section 8 program, which is also called the Housing Choice Program, which provides vouchers to people to help them afford private rentals. And then it also subsidizes a lot of middle-class mortgages through Federal Housing Administration. And finally, it disperses a lot of money around the country in the form of community development block grants, which is money that goes out to cities and towns to kind of use as they see fit to help struggling neighborhoods.
A lot of eyes were on the Trump administration and what they do with an agency like HUD. And then Ben Carson becomes the nominee and then the secretary of the department. Talk about where he came from and why he was seen as an unlikely choice for HUD.
Well, he was an unlikely choice because he's a famous doctor, a pediatric neurosurgeon at Johns Hopkins, and very esteemed in that area. But he has never worked in government, nor really in housing or social policy in any form. He was initially considered to be the Secretary of Health and Human Services or the Surgeon General, but he actually was kind of reluctant to do that. Those jobs, because I think he was aware of just how little he really knew about health policy. So for some reason, he was less reluctant to take on the job of running HUD. My sense is that he really thought he was qualified for that job, really kind of by virtue of having grown up in the inner city himself, having grown up in poverty or near poverty in Detroit, and that's simply his upbringing itself had given him insights into what it would take to run what is in some ways kind of our anti-poverty department.
HUD has seen ups and downs in funding over the years, a lot of downs leading into recent years, but you say that HUD faces now an existential crisis. Why?
Really on two different levels. For starters, they are now facing just massive budget cuts in the White House's proposed budget, a 15% budget cut that would really eviscerate the department, require Section 8 voucher holders to pay a lot more of their income toward their rent, cut the public housing capital fund that pays for renovations of public housing by 68%. I mean, just huge cuts, way beyond what they've seen before. But on another level, it's really in trouble now because the department is just totally adrift. Dr. Carson has not been providing, sort of a clear sense of direction, an agenda of where he wants to go. There are all sorts of top jobs at the department that are still empty, way more than is the norm for a new administration. There are a lot of good career people who have already left or who are very close to leaving because they are just so demoralized by the total drift and lack of direction. And so what you're seeing at HUD is really what can happen to a government department just through sheer kind of disregard and indifference and just kind of a withering away, withering on the vine. That's really what they're facing now, this department that millions of people still do rely on.
Alec McGillis is with us right now from ProPublica. He's written about housing and urban development, HUD, under the Trump administration and under the secretaryship of Dr. Ben Carson. You've talked, Alec, to a lot of people who work at HUD, who have worked at HUD. What are you hearing from them about the way things have gone in 2017?
Well, just that they are They're just immensely demoralized, and really kind of many of them just facing a real kind of personal dilemma, a crisis about whether to stay or go. On the one hand, they want to stay because they care a lot about the department and the people who are served by its programs. But on the other hand, they're just so depressed by the lack of direction. It's hard to tell whether it's willful or not, but a sort of a grinding of the wheels and the gears, where all these different initiatives are being kind of brought to a halt, and it's hard to tell whether it's just because there's no one upstairs to kind of to approve things and keep things moving forward, or if it's more of a more deliberate attempt to bring everything to a halt. But people are very worried about where things are going. And then, of course, you've got these budget cuts looming that Dr. Carson has not been very aggressive in pushing back at. There's just no real sense that anyone's standing up for the department in this moment where it's really coming under fire.
Are Republicans in Congress on board with cutting funding for HUD, or are there parts of it that Republicans are saying, hey, we're actually getting good benefits here?
Yes, you're absolutely right there. One of the interesting things is that you see Republicans, many Republicans, even some quite conservative ones, pushing back on some of these proposed cuts from the White House. The Community Development Block Grant program that I mentioned earlier is quite popular around the country because it really does allow local leaders to spend this money as they see fit within some parameters. And so that program really has quite a lot of bipartisan support. But even some of the more general housing programs, there are Republicans who recognize how important those programs are for some of the neediest and most vulnerable people in the country. It's not just the low-income folks who rely on these programs. It's a lot of seniors and disabled Americans as well. The cuts are coming from, if you had to sort of name one person, they're coming from Mick Mulvaney, who is President Trump's budget director. And Mick Mulvaney was a very, very, very conservative congressman from South Carolina, a real, real budget hawk, and he's now the guy in charge of putting out this budget. But the budget still does have to be approved by Congress. Congress does have the last say, and so my hunch is that the cuts in the end will not be as deep as the White House is proposing, but they'll still be pretty deep.
You watched Ben Carson at various meetings, events. Sometimes you got kicked out while trying to cover Ben Carson. What is he like as a leader in speaking to his staff and the public?
Well, he's very he's almost invisible, to be honest. He's been very nearly invisible within the department itself. I mean, he's famously soft-spoken and has not been very very present inside the headquarters. And then even when he's out and about, I was with him in Baltimore on one branch of his so-called listening tour, and it was very strange. He was here for 2 days in Baltimore, where I live, and the entire first day of his itinerary, where he had five or six meetings lined up, was completely secret. They had not announced that he was here for that first day. And even at, some of these things were events that might have made nice photo ops and gotten him some visibility and easy points, political points, but it was completely secret. So I did get a hold of the schedule, and I was kind of tagging along, and they were very much not happy about that, and they kept sort of rushing him out. His team kept rushing him out through back alleys to avoid me. The other thing that was very odd about the visit was that he was accompanied not just by his wife, who's been very present over the last few months, but also by his son, who runs an investment firm, and even his son's wife, his daughter-in-law. They were along for all these high-level meetings with housing officials and whatnot in Baltimore. And I observed at one point the son introducing some businessmen who were trying to pitch HUD on a venture of theirs, introducing them to his dad's top advisors. So it's definitely a very unusual setup now with him at the top of HUD.
What's at risk if HUD doesn't have leadership like it has had in the past, and if these budget cuts go through?
Well, what's at risk is that the department, there's just a very direct impact on the people who rely on these programs. So if you're a Section 8 voucher holder, you're going to have to pay more toward your rent, And if you're on a waiting list to get a Section 8 voucher, your odds of getting off that waiting list are going to get even worse. If you're in public housing, the state of that public housing is going to deteriorate even more, you know, boiler breakdowns and roof leaks. But beyond that, when you have a department that degrades in its sort of capacity and its morale, it performs less well. And the government, you know, starts to seem even more dysfunctional and incompetent, and it then feeds the whole narrative that the government can't do anything and then we might as well just cut it further or, you know, get rid of this or that program. It really just becomes a vicious cycle.
Alec, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Alec McGillis covers politics and government for ProPublica. His recent article, Is Anybody at Home at HUD?, appeared in New York Magazine. Coming up, we'll look at today's unions and the role they play in the modern economy. That's coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a lot of families are dealing with high costs and uncertainty when it comes to long-term senior care. Our guest tells us what's driving those costs. First, Labor Day in the United States is a way to honor workers and to mark the American labor movement and its history. Unions played a big role in many of the gains of American workers, including five-day work weeks and the minimum wage. The Economic Policy Institute just released a new report called How Today's Unions Help Working People. Central Times executive producer Judith Sears-Poisson talked to the president of the Economic Policy Institute, Larry Mischel, last week about the report.
How exactly would you say unions fit into today's U.S. economy?
Well, unions are a weaker force than they used to be. They represent about 11% of all the workforce. They are a much more diverse collection of people than they're known to be or thought to be, with about 46% being women, about 36% being people of color. And they represent workers in all sorts of industries, manufacturing and construction, as people think, but also in health and transportation, moving into digital media and other matters. A lot of white-collar workers, about 40% of union members these days have a bachelor's degree or more.
You said that it's declined. What was kind of the golden age of unions, would you say?
Well, in the 1950s, unions represented about 30-35% of all the workers. They've especially lost a presence in the private sector. Public sector workers grew more unionized over this period, and private sector workers less so. But what really matters, in my view, is that this erosion of collective bargaining and union. The reason why there's a lot of wage inequality while men's wages in the middle has fallen behind those at the top, the single biggest reason is the erosion of collective bargaining.
And remind us what collective bargaining is exactly.
Well, collective bargaining is when people get together and they form a union and they have rights to, and they do, negotiate with their employer over wages, hours, and working conditions. And that's a right given to them by law, the National Labor Relations Act passed in the 1930s. If you're in the private sector, in the public sector, the laws are dependent upon what your state has decided.
And who benefits the most from that element of collective bargaining, would you say?
Well, what I was saying was that the loss of collective bargaining has fallen most heavily on men, and not just men that are in unions or used to be in unions, but when unions had a strong presence in an occupation or an industry, the wages of non-union employers and the benefits the non-union employers offered most of the time mimicked what was in the unionized agreements by the unionized employers, because they didn't want their workers to leave them and go to the union sector, where they were afraid that the union organizer would show up and organize them. So the biggest single loss of wages because from the erosion of unions is actually of the non-union workers who no longer get a boost because employers are less fearful of becoming unionized.
So you write a lot about the benefits that being in a union brings to the workers that that union represents, but you also say that the unions work on protecting workers and things like collective bargaining also benefit non-union workers. Can you explain that for us?
Well, that, yes. So when you have collective bargaining has a strong presence in an occupation or an industry, it not only helps the workers in that industry, but it also helps boost the wages and benefits that are received by the non-union workers, because their employers, the employers who remain non-union, mimic the standards set in the union sector. They don't want their workers leaving them to go to a unionized firm. Or they may be fearful that if they pay too little, their workers will choose to join a union, and they might want to avoid that. So the biggest single loss of wages in the economy to non-union workers is actually from the loss of collective bargaining, because they lose that. That's been especially true for men, who are blue-collar or don't have a college degree.
We're talking with Larry Michel. He's president of the Economic Policy Institute, and we're discussing their new report detailing the role that unions play in the U.S. economy. And Larry, in the report, you also write that unions strengthen democracy by giving workers a voice in policy debates. How does that work, and can you give us an example of that?
Well, we know that people participate more in the electoral process when they have a union that informs them of what's going on. They're much more likely to vote. We know that unions are one of the few organizations that weigh in on fundamental matters that that affect people's working conditions. Are you going to be able to get unemployment compensation? Are you going to get workers' compensation? Is there going to be safety and health regulations? All those types of matters that affect everybody's working conditions really rely very heavily on the power of workers and through their unions talking to policymakers. And you can see where in states where unions are not very strong, they don't have very good systems. Texas doesn't even have a workers' compensation system. Florida doesn't even have a Department of Employment or Labor that seeks to protect workers from wage theft and other things. So I don't think we will ever have a robust democracy unless we have strong unions that allow people who don't have a lot of money to really weigh in on the policy choices in front of politicians.
So policy debates are often part of elections, are part of legislation, and there have been critiques that just like super PACs and other outside third-party sources of money, that unions can have a big influence on elections and more often than not are supporting Democratic candidates over Republican candidates. How would you respond to that?
Well, when there's money that unions put into the political process to politicians, it's not actually from the regular dues, it's from additional voluntary contributions that people make into the PACs. And, unions do weigh in on matters. Many do support Republicans. Some unions do and some don't. But people should see, who is it that is representing the interest of workers when it comes to the bread and butter issues. Who's protecting OSHA, occupational safety and health? Who's protecting the unemployment comp system, the worker comp system? Who's fighting for a higher minimum wage? Who wants to get people paid leave, paid sick leave, all these other matters? You'll find that, the expansion of labor protections, the elimination of things like child labor, the people who brought you the weekend are the unions, says a T-shirt I own. These are all things that only came about by agitation by workers organized through their unions.
In 2011 here in Wisconsin, we saw Wisconsin's Act 10 law passed, an effort to curb unions and those especially of public sector employees, including a measure to limit collective bargaining. Is that a trend that you see across the country at this point?
Well, Wisconsin followed some attacks in New Jersey by Chris Christie, but Wisconsin did start a bit of a trend. It later followed up with a so-called right-to-work law, which undercuts unions in the private sector, which Governor Walker said he wasn't going to attack when he did Act 10, but he later did turn on the private sector unions. It did create a wave of some similar anti-union legislation. It was defeated in Ohio in a referendum. Some of the right-to-work laws were passed in Indiana and Michigan, and I think most recently, you know, Kentucky. And Missouri is fighting over that right now. So, yeah, I mean, it did start a trend, and, you know, in my view, not a very happy trend.
And as we wrap up, Larry, the report concludes that there's a need to rebuild collective bargaining and union representation. How optimistic are you that that's in the near future?
Well, what I do know is that if you ask workers in polls, would they want to choose collective bargaining, and do they believe a majority of their peers at work would want to choose collective bargaining tomorrow if they could vote on that, that you get around half the workers say that they would. And, you know, of course, that's far more than the people who have collective bargaining. So there's a vast unmet demand for people who want to choose collective bargaining as a way to resolve their problems. And I think they ought to be given that. And I think ultimately we're not going to be able to achieve shared prosperity that includes a robust middle class unless we do get collective bargaining. So I think the country will eventually turn to restoring collective bargaining. The exact form that takes, I think, is uncertain at this point. But, you know, the political odds aren't good in 2017 to see that legislation, or 2018. But we'll see what happens in 2021.
Well, Larry, thanks so much for joining us today.
Okay, thank you.
That was Larry Michel, president of the Economic Policy Institute. He talked to Central Times executive producer Judith Sears-Poisson last week about a new report from the EPI about unions in the United States. Coming up, whether you're thinking of your own needs later in life or those of your parents, the cost of long-term care can be cause for worry. We'll talk to an economist about why care is so expensive and what would need to change in order to fix it. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow morning after 6 on the Joy Cardine Show, after 7, a look at the aftermath of Hurricane Harvey and the politics of federal relief funding. It's tomorrow morning after 7 here on the Ideas Network. First, many families in Wisconsin are dealing with the costs of long-term care for seniors or are worried about the potential for high costs in the future. According to a survey from the Associated Press, only about a third of older Americans have saved any money for long-term care expenses. Only 15% of those surveyed say they're extremely confident or very confident that they can afford those expenses. Many people expect Medicare coverage to pay for significant costs, but while Medicare can help with direct medical treatment costs, it doesn't generally cover the kinds of assistance people may need in performing daily tasks when they're suffering serious health impairments. Christine Bishop joins us now. She's an economist and professor at the Heller School at Brandeis University. She was a senior staff member on a U.S. Senate Commission on Long-Term Care back in 2013. Christine, thanks for joining us today.
I'm so pleased to be here. Wherever I go as an economist, if I'm just talking with people, everyone has a story about trying to make long-term care work for someone in their family. And the economics of this are really important.
Well, yeah, and the origin of wanting to talk about this, I was talking to a group of WPR listeners in their 60s and 70s a month or so ago, and a lot of them had stories about the cost of care for their parents, and they were worried about their own situation in the years to come. How big an issue is this nationwide?
Well, we are spending a lot as a nation and a society on this issue. We use a lot of resources for long-term services and supports for older adults. Currently, there are about 7 million people who are receiving these services, and it's well over $200 billion. And the nursing home is likely what you think of first. That serves about 1.5 million people. We have assisted living and paid home services, and all of these are very expensive. But the biggest cost is the time and effort of family and friends, informal caregivers and who are spouses and adult children and friends, and they're not paid, so sometimes they're thought of as free care, but this is also a huge resource for our care needs.
And this is something that can be really hard to prepare for, and you mentioned this to me when we chatted briefly yesterday. Some people are going to need a lot of expensive care. Some people are going to need almost nothing, and you don't know which it's going to be for you. So it's, how do you start to prepare for something like that?
Absolutely. The burden of costs of the need for care doesn't fall evenly, and it's about half of all people who turn 65 who will not need substantial long-term services and supports in their remaining lifetime. But at the high end of this need, there are about 14% of people will spend more than 5 years with a pretty high level of need, where they'll need care from a family member or paid care. And this is a very variable expense, and it's very hard to prepare for as an individual or as a family. It's really a problem.
And people often think, it sounds like, that Medicare is going to cover a lot of the costs, and that may be true for very specific medical parts of care. But when we're talking about a person with some kind of impairment where they need help, you know, living day to day, that is generally, as I understand it, not covered by Medicare.
That's absolutely true, that the Medicare program was designed for acute health needs. It does cover chronic health needs. If you need skilled nursing after a hospital admission, Medicare will cover a certain number of days, and it will cover some home health, but it does not cover care if what you need is help with function. Everyday tasks of daily living become difficult for people with functional impairment, and help with eating, with getting around, with dressing, with grooming, with getting to the bathroom are just not covered by Medicare.
Talking to Christine Bishop from Brandeis University, looking at the costs of long-term care for seniors. Christine, let's look at that institutional situation now. Somebody who needs more or less around-the-clock care, or at least access to that. Can you talk about how big a financial burden that can be for people?
Well, the average cost of a private room in a nursing home is well over $200 a day. And so people who do need nursing home care go into the nursing home, and they can spend all of their assets quite quickly on that. So in many states, Medicaid will take care of people who become poor as well as those who are poor. Medicaid is designed originally as a program to assist people without means, but middle-class people can go into a nursing home and spend their assets and their income on the cost of care, and then go onto Medicaid. So that's really why Medicaid covers so much of our nursing home care in this country. If you look at the total amount of nursing home care that's really long-term care, it's 63% that Medicaid covers. And looking at that from the other side, by the way, that's a huge burden for states, that states are challenged to come up with a budget to take care of people who are in nursing homes and have become or are Medicaid eligible.
And we have a thing called long-term care insurance that people can buy. Is that working as a solution?
Well, that was very promising about 20 years ago. I was very excited about it because it seemed to be an answer to sharing these burdens across more people, pooling across people. And people started to buy it, and it seemed to work very well. They assess people for need, and the insurance can kick in. It covers people now for care at home. And we did a study that found that people with this insurance were able to stay home at quite a high level of need for a longer period of time than people without this insurance, because they were getting some help with costs for home care. Currently, the insurance companies are having a lot of challenges with this, and we're finding them walking away from this business. I mean, anyone who's purchased insurance will have that covered. There is a promise to keep going with the insurance, but they aren't writing new policies at the rate that they were. So this does not seem to be working so well, and people have called it a niche market, that it's maybe designed for quite upper middle income people who can pay the high premiums.
Let's look at the cost side of things now. Is it the case that whether we're talking institutional care or hired home health care, are those things too costly now? Or is it just a fact that these are expensive things that to provide these services?
We don't see the kind of waste and abuse and so on that is alleged for our medical system. We don't see super high fees because it's a very competitive market. Medicaid pays at a pretty low rate in many places, and when the private payer is involved, they're going to shop for care, and so I don't think we've got waste and abuse here. We do have a basic fundamental issue that long-term services and supports requires hands-on care from another person, real services from an individual who is going to help the client, the person with the needs. And that means that as our economy keeps going and productivity goes up in other areas, we are going to have to pay these people a wage to draw them into the market. And I would even say we are not paying them enough now. So it's not as if these things are overly expensive or luxurious.
Let's talk about those workers a bit. We've talked about that here in Wisconsin. People who do a home health care, various forms of nurses' assistants, other jobs at the lower levels are, I think, notoriously low paying here and around the country. Why is that?
I think there's a feeling with a lot of so-called care work that anybody can do it. And I would argue a bit differently, that people who are drawn into this field are really using their caring and emotional resources and ought to be compensated for that. They really are getting to know their clients, their residents, and how they like to be taken care of. And when we have high turnover in that field, either on a nursing home unit or for the person that's coming to a home to take care of an older adult, all that knowledge is lost, and a new person comes in the next day and starts with care that can be very intimate and so on. So I've been doing studies to try to find out how these jobs are organized, how we could make them better jobs so that people would feel more respected and valued. And part of it will be higher wages.
We're talking about the costs of long-term senior care with Christine Bishop from the Heller School at Brandeis University. You can join the conversation over on the Central Time Facebook page. Is this an issue you're dealing with in your family or worried about for the near future? What kind of costs are you seeing? How are you covering them? Are you providing free senior care for a family member? How does that affect your life? And if you work in senior care, what kind of things are you seeing? You can share your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation here on Central Time in just a bit. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation now about the cost of long-term care for seniors. Christine Bishop is with us from the Heller School at Brandeis University. You can join the conversation on the Central Time Facebook page. Is this an issue for you? Are you dealing with the cost of providing long-term care for yourself or a member of your family? Let us know over on the Central Time Facebook page. Christine, before we go to our callers, you were on a commission a few years back looking at solutions. What kind of solutions are out there to this fairly complicated issue?
Well, the fundamental issue, I would say, for our society and our politics is that this has been seen as an individual and family responsibility, and it's hard to move the needle to get people to think about sharing it across many people. That can be done through private insurance, of course, but I believe we need to have some kind of public program that's going to make sure that people are sharing these costs. And that was the fundamental divide on this commission, which was made up of representatives appointed by both the Democratic and the Republican sides of our Congress. There are some ways of dealing with this that we see abroad, where Germany and Japan and some other countries really have made this a part of their social insurance scheme to make sure that there is a basic level of long-term services and supports that people will have access to.
Let's bring on our callers now at 800-642-1234. Joya is with us in Fitchburg. Joya, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I went through this experience for 3 years. My husband had a Parkinson's disease. He passed away from Parkinson's disease 2 years ago. And he wanted to pass away at home, so I had to arrange for the home caregiver and with the local agencies. And when I interviewed them, they said, you know, we'll send two people, you know, on a consistent basis. And but you know, in reality, they send me more than six people, because of the two people, one person could not come. They send somebody totally new who did not know how to take care of the person. And, you know, I had to stay awake at night and to take care of him. And number one, for that, they would not deduct any money, though, that the person was incompetent caregiver.
Joya, thanks for the call. Very sorry for that difficult situation and for your loss. But, Christine, there it is. Hard to get reliable services, Joya's saying, and that issue of turnover. Ideally, you'd like to have the same people coming to provide that care.
Absolutely. And we should be thinking more carefully about what the jobs are like for these people, and making sure they have good orientation and training and enough pay and benefits to find it worthwhile to stick with the job.
Joya, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Diane with us in Sheboygan. Diane, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to make the comment that I've been working in the senior care industry for like 23 years, and I've been an administrator in assisted living. And I always make the comparison. My husband works at Miller Brewing Company, and we pay brewery workers almost $30 an hour to make beer in Wisconsin. Yet we pay our caregivers like $9 an hour to care for our seniors. And that just, I think, is just kind of exemplifies, you know, the thought process of the state, well, across the country, really.
Diane, thanks for the call. $9 an hour, she says, for caregivers in assisted living. Is this an issue of priorities, Christine?
It also is a kind of market situation. People will do this work for $9, but they can't afford almost to have the kind of commitment that we would see from the beer workers. I'd be curious to do a comparative study of those manufacturing workers versus the assisted living workers, and the amount of knowledge that people build up on the job is probably similar, even though it's about different subjects, obviously.
Thanks for that call, Diane. We're talking to Christine Bishop from Brandeis University. She researches long-term care for seniors, and that's the issue we're talking about, the costs of caring for seniors. You can join us at 800-642-1234. We'll go next to Judith on the line in Spooner. Judith, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So I was making the point that when you do have private pay, you tend to be gouged, because you have to be paying for those low returns on Medicaid. And because there's such a high percentage of Medicaid patients, I'm paying over $12,000 a month for my mother to be in a long-term care facility. And when her money's gone, then she will go on Medicaid. but they try and make up their loss by private pay and, in essence, gouging people. And every month I learn something new, and recently learned that doesn't even cover her medication. I have to pay that separate. So I'll just leave it there.
Judith, thanks for the call, and good luck in dealing with that situation. Christine, is that the case? Medicaid, low reimbursement rates. So if I'm operating a facility, I'm saying at least I'm not making a lot on Medicaid patients. I have to charge more for people paying out of pocket?
Well, the nursing homes, in order to stay open, they are facing what economists would call a two-part market. And the theory would say that they're charging they won't take Medicaid patients unless they are paying at least their additional costs. But it's likely that the private pay residents are covering the overhead costs, so that you do see different prices for these two parts of the market. It's interesting that the private pay residents have, many of them, migrated toward assisted living. So nursing homes are having a tough time staying open. They're closing in our state here in Massachusetts, and there's just been a shift in the market. So, again, I think we need to think about a total public policy toward this, so that the people who really need nursing home care will have it there for them when they need it.
So you're saying we need to think about a public policy, but are we thinking about public policy on this? We hear a lot of the debate over, you know, the health care, the Affordable Care Act, the American Health Care Act. Are people even treating this as a policy issue?
Painfully, for someone who's been working on this for many years, this has been on the back burner in recent years, partly because of how important solving our health insurance situation has been. And we do need to solve the health insurance issues first. But there are groups in Washington who are trying to get together in a bipartisan way and think about how we should be financing long-term care. So there is some hope on the horizon, I would say.
And is this something that states could be doing at the local level, basic inaction from the federal government?
Absolutely. Hawaii actually came very close to passing a statewide long-term care program that would help residents of Hawaii. Now, they're a little different because they're sort of isolated. I mean, you can imagine what the issues are for states where people could migrate in and out to get a better long-term care deal. But states may have to step up on this and be the lead on it.
Christine, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
That was Christine Bishop, economist and professor at the Heller School at Brandeis University. She was a senior staff member on U.S. Senate Commission on Long-Term Care in 2013. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, the Milwaukee branch of the NAACP reacts to the leaked draft of a federal report on policing in the city. And we'll find out why Wisconsin is on the cutting edge of the pizza farm movement in the United States. That and the latest news coming up tomorrow on Central Time.